This is the War Room. Third hour is on. We're connecting with my guest, Andrew F. Bronca, right now. Very excited to talk. I imagine we'll probably continue to discuss this compact article, or at least the anti-white agenda of the powers that be, since he talks about that quite a bit from a very sophisticated position of knowledge. But just to close out here, and then I want to go to a video of Bronca that he published a few days ago. I just want to read the last sentence, really, of this Compact Magazine article, because I have an answer. He asked a question, and I have an answer for him, okay? Again, the whole thing is heartbreaking, and he basically talks about contending with the fact, like coming to terms with the fact that he's never going to be the success that he thought he should have been, and trying to get over some of the, like, hatred that he feels for the people that he felt gatekept him out of what he should have been able to earn. He says, there's wounded pride here. How could there not be? I have two sons. I used to imagine long before they were born that I would take them to film sets, that I'd bring them along to exotic locations. Instead, their father spends most of his working day in his bedroom scrolling through spreadsheets and ticket listings. What do I say when my boys ask about my old hopes and dreams? What do I tell them when they ask about theirs? Well, you pathetic, sad sack, you need to buck up, bucko. Your children are probably going to have to actually literally fight for their lives against the same forces that have depressed and beaten you down. So what you need to tell your kids is not be sad, oh, they screwed us over, oh, poor white men. Tell them you have to fight for everything that you earn. And there are people out there that are very sophisticated and are very capable and are very evil and are using it to discriminate against you because you represent something they're not. You represent something that they can't achieve. And that's a burden on you, but it's also a brilliant gift. And you have to take that and you have to fight for everything that you've got. And you have to understand that this is the world, and you don't pass on to your kid the race-blind egalitarianism that left you a victim of all of this bullcrap. You need to tell them what's really going on, what the real world is about. Not that they're victims, not that it's hopeless, but that they're going to have to get serious and they're going to have to start early, and they're playing like Maximus in the last fight of Gladiator. They've been stabbed in the liver. They've been abused and starved and tortured, and now they have to go out in the arena and fight for their life. And the good news is they're more than capable of winning. I understand and I empathize with, and I think it's important to illustrate and to discuss the tragedy that this represents, the individual tragedies of lost hopes, lost dreams, feeling inadequate, passing that on to your children. It's important to illustrate that, but I have to say this article has a defeatist attitude that I can't stomach. Oh, my old hopes and dreams. Okay, so you were delusional when you were young. Big deal. To even have two children that you live with is a success. And all, like, again, just tell your kids, just let your sons know the world is unfair. Tribe up. That's what you tell them. Tell them, I got screwed by this system, but you don't have to. And when it comes time to send them to school, if the school tries to teach them to hate themselves, tries to teach them inaccurate views of history, and you don't sigh, and you don't shrug your shoulders and roll your eyes and say, oh, woe is me. You go to the school and you figuratively kick the goddamn door down and demand that they stop poisoning the mind of your child. You start acting like everybody else in your story. Throughout this whole story, there's the cynical, exploitative old white boomers. There's the cowardly little gay millennials. There's the Gen Z twinks. Nowhere is there just white people not putting up with it, not standing for it, not feeling sorry for themselves, but being invigorated by the fact that you're now in a fight for your life. And that you can win, and that it's fun to win, and that it makes the victory mean something against these odds.
challenging all of you to support the broadcast, keep us on air while you get great products, and it's a win-win. We need funds, we are in the red, and we've got to be able to continue our legal battles. We've got to be able to continue to buy a new product going in the future. We've got to continue with the funding to build the Alex Jones backup network in case they're able to shut us down. I cannot do it without you. So now is the time to go to thealexjonesstore.com and do your final Christmas shopping there. Anywhere in the United States, if you order by Friday, you will get it before Christmas. So get your orders in now. Do your Christmas shopping with us, but really give yourself the gift of health with our creatine gummies, the highest quality type of creatine, 5 milligrams. That's a daily serving per gummy. Huge container of them. Such a great deal. This is the best creatine out there. There's so many other great products and a whole bunch of other sales and deals. You can become a subscriber right now on any product, cancel any time, and it reorders every month and get 50% off on all future orders. The widest selection of t-shirts, hoodies, ball caps, sweaters, many of them limited edition at thealexjonesstore.com.
You're tuned into The War Room with your host, Harrison Smith. Watch it live right now on X.com.
All right, welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is The War Room. I'm your host, Harrison Smith. You support InfoWars by going to thealexjonesstore.com. Go there today, take advantage of the incredible sales that we have, and get your order in by New Year's so you can start the new year off right, hitting your resolution goals with all of the supplementation that can help get you there, thealexjonesstore.com. With that, I'm very happy to welcome my guest, Andrew F. Branca, attorney and host of The Branca Show, providing a pro-American, pro-Constitution, pro-Western civilization, political and legal analysis with bonus jokes and laughter along with it. You can follow him on X at The Branca Show. That's T-H-E-B-R-A-N-C-A show, and youtube.com/@TheBrancaShow. Mr. Branca, thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, it's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Oh, the pleasure's all mine, and I don't know how I didn't find you earlier, but ever since you started showing up on my X feed, I'm like, I got to get this guy on. Yesterday, I asked our producer, Scott, to reach out, and he said, well, is there anything in particular that you want to talk to him about? And I'm like, I think I could talk to him about anything. You cover a wide swath of topics, and you seem to have a in-depth knowledge of just about everything you discuss. Is there an area of expertise that you have? How'd you get started doing this, and what compels you to speak out like this?
I mean, by profession, I'm a criminal defense attorney. I specialize in self-defense law. That's my day job, thelawofselfdefense.com. But I've been on the planet for 60 years, 61 years this week, and I've seen things happening. I have some life experience. I have some perspectives. And I would start to talk to people about these things on social media, what's happening in the world today. And it became obvious to me that I saw things that were quite obvious to me based on my life experience that were not obvious to them. And it was a situation where I would point something out. And once they saw it, they could not unsee it. The reality became clear to them. But I realized that until it was pointed out, they were blinded by the propaganda that's out there in the mainstream media, the legacy media, the institutions. And it was I found I really enjoyed opening people's eyes to a different perspective of what was really going on and help them understand their place in the world and what they could do to, well, stop being abused by the world as we are today.
Well, and the way you do it, you have sort of a unique style, because what you're saying feels like it should be offensive, but the way you do it is just very sort of straightforward. And that maybe sounds bad when I say that, but obviously you talk about very sensitive issues. You talk about political hot button issues, but you just sort of give the facts, right? And you don't really get too caught up in the emotions of it. Is that a strategy of yours? Is that just the way you are in general? Are you aware of this, or is that just my perspective on your work?
You know, I just try to be factual. Unfortunately, a lot of facts make people emotionally uncomfortable. So I've grown accustomed to people reacting with estrogenic hysteria to things that are just facts, because it basically hurts their feelings or it makes them feel bad about their place in the world. We live in a world where everyone's supposed to simultaneously be a winner at all the things. And that's just not true. Different people have different strengths and weaknesses. I'm not good at everything, but everyone else is not good at everything either. And I think it's helpful to have a realistic sense of what we are capable of and what we're not, and make our public policy and personal choices accordingly.
Yeah, and you bring a very legal perspective, and that's what I really like about your work. because a lot of times you get talking heads discussing this stuff and they go all sorts of directions. One video that I really liked of yours was talking about Judge Boasberg and the way that he was trying to hold the Trump administration in contempt. And I had no idea of how absurd it was, but then you laid it out really simply. Can you not to redo your video here live, but can you explain sort of what's going on with Judge Boasberg and the Trump administration and he's trying to hold them in contempt?
Yeah, I mean, I find it's always very useful to go back to first principles, especially as a lawyer, and start from there, because the progressive left loves to obscure things with endless complexity to hide from you what's really going on. It's like these guys in the subway platforms with their cups and the little ball under the cup, and you're supposed to guess which one it is. That's why they come up with this fake academic type of language that they use. It's all just an effort, an obfuscation. Boasberg set a trap for Trump. And we know he set a trap because months before, right after Trump was reelected, but before he was sworn in, Boasberg was at a judicial conference. Chief Justice John Roberts was there. By the way, Boasberg's lifelong friends. I think they might have roomed in law school together.
Really?
And Boasberg, I call him Count Boasberg because of his vampiric appearance, right. Chief Judge of the District of Columbia, District Court, Federal Courts. He stands up at the conference and he says, hey, I just want to plant a seed in all the federal judges' minds. We should be ready for when Trump disobeys our court orders. And Chief Justice John Roberts is there and says, hey, what are you talking about? There's no indication he's going to do this. Why are we inviting trouble? If that happens, we'll address it. But let's not presume that'll be the case. And then months later, Boasberg happens to be in his office, home early from vacation, at 1 o'clock in the morning, in his chambers. And he's not the emergency judge assigned for the weekend. But at 1 o'clock in the morning, he's in his chambers and he catches the first Alien Enemies Act civil suit that's filed against Trump. Just happens to be there.
What a coincidence.
And then he has a hearing about it. And at the hearing, he says, listen, I'm going to talk about a bunch of stuff in the hearing. I don't want the Trump administration, you lawyers for Trump, I don't want you taking any notes. At the end of the meeting, I'll issue a written order that tells you what to do. And he issues a written order. They follow the written order to the letter. And now he's saying the oral comments I told you not to take notes on, well, that was also an order. And you didn't obey those. So I'm going to hold you in criminal contempt of court. It was purely a trap set by him.
And this was about the extradition flights to El Salvador, right? And the discrepancy right. was he said you can't send any more flights, but he didn't say anything about pulling the flights back that were already en route. But then, you know, it's found out that, well, their one flight had already left. Landed after he gave the order, he says, you disobeyed my order. But in the written order, there said nothing about bringing people back, only no more planes were to be sent. It's impossible to not send a plane that was already sent before the written order. So just, and again, my question is like, how does he get away with this? Because that seems so blatant to me. If it's not in the written order, how is he claiming that they're not following the written order? Like, how do they keep getting away with this stuff?
Well, we let them. And by we, of course, I mean the system. There are ways to hold judges in check. I mean, you can impeach them in the House and vote to remove them in the Senate. You need 67 votes for that. We don't have 67 votes. All these judges know it. The Supreme Court could hold these judges in check. They could take cases away from them. They could reassign them. But the Supreme Court doesn't like to do that, especially Chief Justice Roberts. He's a particular kind of Chief Justice. He likes things to work in an orderly fashion. He likes to presume that all the federal judges are acting in good faith, despite the overwhelming evidence that that's not the case. They're acting explicitly in bad faith again and again and again. And it's just we don't have a mechanism that allows for we don't have a system that's designed to deal with a large number of federal judges acting in bad faith. Our founders just did not build a system for that. They presumed that we would not put people like that in positions of authority of federal judges with lifetime appointments. They would never have imagined, our founders would never have imagined, for example, that we could have in the D.C. District Court 15 federal district court judges, five of whom were not born in America. At least two of them maintain dual citizenship. I mean, to have people not born in America be given lifetime appointments as federal judges who believe, unbelievably, that they have the authority to order about, these unelected judges to order about our democratically elected Article II executive branch president would be beyond the founders' imagining. But that's the world we've created for ourselves.
It is absolutely insane. And even the topic of lifetime appointments is not really a thing, right? I believe that was another video of yours. I watch a lot of your videos pretty much every time you crop up. I know I'm going to learn something. But I believe it was one of yours about the fact that there's nowhere it says a lifetime appointment. It says if they have good behavior, but it's never really defined what good behavior is. So it seems like you could, take that to mean that Trump could basically fire them at will. Is that right?
Well, I'm not sure Trump could, but I think there's an alternative way to remove judges from the bench other than impeachment. And that is Article 3 of the Constitution. We hold the political, what we call the political branches of government, Article 1, Congress, Article 2, the executive branch. We hold them accountable to the political will of the American people by having elections. We set terms of office and have elections. The Article 3 judiciary is supposed to be an apolitical branch of government, the least powerful, one that does not engage in policymaking. So we don't have a set term for those guys. But Article 3 does not literally say it's a lifetime appointment. It says judges serve during good behavior. Literally, that's Section 1 of Article 3. And we've just interpreted serve during good behavior to mean a lifetime appointment because we're presuming judges will act in good faith and serve with good behavior as federal judges. Again, it's a system that's not well suited to judges willing to act in bad faith. And I think if that's the condition of the Constitution and every word in the Constitution is presumed to mean something, to have meaning, it's not redundant. So this has to mean serve during good behavior, has to mean something different than impeachment, which is a separate power in the Constitution. If it means something different, well, then if a judge is not serving during good behavior, he no longer qualifies to serve on the bench. He can see just be fired. How was he hired in the first place? He was hired by a majority vote in the Senate. By my reading, he could be fired by a majority vote in the Senate, not for having committed a high crime and misdemeanor, not like you've committed a felony, that's why we're firing. You're just not doing your job. You're not being an impartial, unbiased jurist on the bench. And if you're not serving during good behavior, you're fired.
And some of these people, as you point out, I mean, they're literally not American. I mean, they're dual citizens or they're foreign born. A lot of them, I mean,
they're foreign born. They've all at least been naturalized citizens. But I have to be honest, in a lot of these cases, I consider, there's a difference between a cultural American citizen and a technical naturalized American citizen
who's
still
American.
Culturally a member of his own foreign nationality. Like one of the judges that was admitted to the federal bench after Trump, a Biden judge, admitted, raised to the bench after Trump was elected, but before he was sworn in, I think he's the first Muslim judge on the D.C. Circuit, young guy. He wasn't born in America. He was born in Canada. He was born in Canada to Egyptian migrant parents. I mean, he's culturally Egyptian. And he moved to America. I think he got a citizenship naturalized like 5 years ago or 6 years ago. He's barely an American citizen. He's certainly not culturally an American citizen. And yet Biden gave that guy a lifetime appointment to the federal bench. It's outrageous.
And if you look at these guys' CVs, it's not like they were, a hot shot lawyer and then became a judge. A lot of them are literally just activists.
That's him.
Usually in like an NGO. What did this guy do? He might have actually done something. But for a lot of these judges, I mean, they spend 20 years being a paid activist, getting more people into the country, using, their legal background in order to circumvent the immigration system and bring in as many immigrants as possible. After 20 years of that, they slap a robe on them and say, you're in charge now. It is absurd. And we've shown this data before where, under people like Bush and Obama, there would be like under 10 injunctions from judges. Under Trump, it's like 175. So it seems like that alone would be enough to say these judges are being biased. We don't have to listen to them because they're not actually acting in good faith. The numbers alone, I think, make that argument.
The numbers raise a red flag, but it's theoretically. But one thing we have to keep in mind, in fairness, is Trump is a much more aggressive executive than we've ever had, certainly in my lifetime. And when you're an executive, an aggressive executive, you're doing a lot of things that have not been done before. You're breaking norms. And that will lead to a lot of people to object and try to seek TROs and seek preliminary injunctions. So I think one of the reasons we're getting a lot of at least requests for them is because of the dramatic things that Trump is doing. But I read these arguments. And these arguments do not warrant the actual issuance of a temporary restraining order or a preliminary injunction. They're clearly being granted by these judges simply because these liberal judges, and by the way, they all come from a relatively small number of these federal judges. Now, all these cases are concentrated where these NGOs and these lawyers for terrorists know they can get assigned a liberal judge. And these liberal judges are just acting from pure political animus against the president. They're Trump deranged because we know this, because they'll issue an injunction and get it rapidly overturned by the Court of Appeals. And then they'll just issue a second injunction and get it overturned and a third injunction on some other crazy legal theory. None of these are on the merits. We're just very fortunate that when it gets to the Court of Appeals, we have like a 50-50 chance of getting adults in the room to hold these feckless district trial court judges in check. And thank God when we get to the Supreme Court, we have a 5 or 6 justice majority that's. But of course, all of this consumes time, it consumes months, and they know this. So part of what they're doing is just acting as a brake on the Trump MAGA agenda and slowing everything down.
Yeah, it's absolutely infuriating. And as you point out, I mean, it is so undemocratic. I mean, for these people to, you know, be supporting this and employing this strategy when they spend the rest of their time crying about democracy and the norms. These are unelected people who I'd never even heard of before they issued these injunctions. How these random nobodies have the ability to override the president of the United States continuously about everything. It's infuriating. And I worry that it's not like on purpose, because I'm to the point, I'm like a libertarian, right? I don't want the executive branch to have unchecked power. That's horrifying. But we're getting to the point where it's like, we can't have these judges interfering. So it's almost like by using the judges so much and so inappropriately, and they're so abusing their power, it's got people like me begging for an unaccountable executive branch. Obviously, I haven't gone that far, but that's the impulse. So it seems to me almost like if they mess things up this badly, then they'll just get what they want anyway, which is an unaccountable executive branch. Do you think that goes into the calculus at all?
Well, first of all, I would say, listen, when I was a young man, I was a libertarian, too. I've grown to believe that libertarianism is a luxury belief that America cannot afford in its current crisis. But having said that, President Trump, he's not unchecked. There's a ton of checks on his authority. Now, he controls all the executive authority. Article 2, Section 1 of the Constitution says the executive authority of the government shall be vested in a president, a single president, one person. It's unique. In our constitutional order, right? We have the legislative branch, Article 1. There's hundreds of them, congressmen and senators. We have the Article 3 federal courts. There's at least 9 Supreme Court justices, and then there's 844. We distribute this power over a large number of people in Article 1 and Article 3. When it comes to Article 2, every scintilla of executive power is put in one president, and that's the way our founders designed the system. That's not an overreach of authority. That's the authority given to the president. And what doesn't he have? He doesn't have money. Congress controls the power of the purse. He's constrained by the actual Constitution. And that's enforced by the judiciary. For example, even these Trende Aragua terrorists, they are entitled to some due process of law. They don't get none. They get at least a habeas hearing. They have a right to be presented in front of a federal judge and have the government explain why they've been detained. Everybody in the U.S. has that right, including terrorists. In fact, the Alien Enemies Act, signed into law by John Adams, includes explicitly that little bit of due process, even for alien enemies of the United States. So there are constraints on the president's power. But the left doesn't like that he has any power. They want him to be the same flaccid executive that a John McCain would have been had he been elected, that a Mitt Romney would have been had he been elected. And Trump just does not give an F. He comes in like a bull. First elected office he's ever had as this president, and he's treating it like he is the CEO, the chief executive officer of the nation, which he damn well is. That's the job. That's how the Constitution defines it. And he's going to exercise his authority as he sees fit in the interests of the United States. But he's not unchecked.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I wanted talk a little bit more about libertarianism, because it's sort of a loaded word. When I use it, I just mean, you know, liberty being my ultimate value, but with the understanding that you can't have liberty without peace and you can't have peace without order. So, you know, sort of taking it from a different angle. But what do you think has led you away from libertarianism? If you say you used to be more libertarianism, what sort of awakening have you gone through to drive you that way?
Well, I mean, the rest of the world, really. If we lived in a purely first world America that appeared like our founders might have expected it to look when they created the nation, I think in that kind of sheltered environment, libertarianism can get some traction. But once it encounters a hostile third world, which is not only uninterested in respecting libertarian values, but is, in my view, cognitively and temperamentally incapable of respecting libertarian views. I think it takes a certain minimum IQ to function in a libertarian mindset. And most of the world does not have that. We're all culturally conditioned to pretend for social purposes that, you know, everyone we meet is about as smart as we are. You know, we're not rude to people about such things. But the truth is just fundamental IQ, the innate hardware ability of the brain to engage in problem solving, higher level thinking, it is not homogeneously distributed among all peoples. You can just get a map of IQ across the globe. And when you look at the first world nations, what they the single most defining characteristic is their high IQ. They have the highest IQ. I'm excluding Asia here because it's not really relevant to our discussion. But among non-Asian peoples, you look at a map of IQ, the countries that have 100 IQ or better on average are Europe, Russia, North America, Australia, places that people like our founders came from. 95, 100 IQ on average. You get to Central and South America, the average IQ drops to 80. You go to North Africa, the Middle East, India, it drops into the 70s. Mentally retarded to 75. Right. You get into sub-Saharan Africa, the average IQs drop into the 60s, sometimes the 50s. These are not people who can do the same things. It doesn't make them bad people. It doesn't make them less loved by God. But it's like you had different computers with different innate hardware capabilities. They're not the same. A Cray supercomputer, an AI, Grok, is not the same as the Commodore 64 that I had as a kid. It's just not. They're both computers, but they're not capable of the same things. So and I think libertarianism cannot survive in a world that's not a first world world. And we don't live there. Only 8% of the population in the world is first world.
Yeah. No,
That's an environment that's very hostile to libertarianism.
I completely agree with you. Do you think there's a intelligence component to morals? Because that's what it seems like to me, that it's sort of the ability to see the second order effects and then to behave that way. Because it's interesting to me that, to me, you can't have liberty if you have people taking advantage of the vulnerabilities of a system, right? Liberty is to have a system that's vulnerable. And if you have people so sort of stupid and short-minded that they're going to, you know, take a shortcut when they ruin it for everybody else, what is the connection between intelligence and morality, do you think?
Well, first of all, for morality to have any meaning, it has to have some kind of biological anchor. Otherwise, it's just personal preference, right? What's immoral is things that I feel icky about. It's just completely relative and subjective. It's not useful. Sure. To me, what's moral behavior is behavior that advances the interest of your family, your tribe, your community, your nation, because that's what facilitates, I mean, just from an evolutionary biology perspective, that's what facilitates the propagation of what you are as a people, right? Your genetic code. But that works at a lot of levels of sophistication. I mean, a primitive tribe might fight with another tribe. They're acting out of their own moral interest. But it may be very tribal, which is what we see from the third world today. It's a very tribal existence. With higher IQ comes a more sophisticated understanding of what it means to be moral. We look out for a broader circle of people, not just our family, not just our immediate tribe, but our county, our state, our nation. We believe we're one people, right? E pluribus unum. We're all acting with a common shared interest. I think it takes a higher level of intelligence to expand morality in that way.
I knew this conversation was going to get interesting. More with Andrew F. Branca on the other side at The Branca Show on X, youtube.com/The Branca Show. I'm telling you, the guy knows his stuff. We'll be right back with more. Don't go anywhere.
My pillow alone, just my pillow, not counting me, it costs them over $200 million directly related to Arctic frost, everybody. What they've done to my company, tried to just wipe them off the face of the earth because I'm out there going, we need to secure our elections. We need to secure our elections. We need to get rid of the machines. We need to go to paper ballots.
You were literally terrorized and targeted, and it's in the documents.
And that thing goes so deep. It's funny, Alex. Things go so far, and then they tend to get stopped. But you guys, just know, I am never stopping. I will never stop. Number one, my number one thing is we need to secure our election platform.
Let's talk about this. People supporting what you're doing and getting the highest quality, you name it, great products. Almost all of it made in America. Your great Giza sheets have that special cotton everybody knows comes from Egypt, which are amazing. Right. I've got some on my king bed. Talk about the incredible products you've got at mypillow.com/Alex. And again, I want to be clear. We are only here still hanging on, but now people support at thealexjonesstore.com or at mypillow.com/Alex is absolutely critical. This is now literally up to you every month whether we're going to stay in this fight. We're both workaholics. We love people. We love telling the truth. You know, these corrupt people, you know, think we're schmucks because we're not corrupt. No, we know how to be corrupt if we wanted to, dumbasses. But we like being good people. That's what builds a society.
We're the tip of the spear. This is it. We only get one shot at this. And like I said, about 2 years ago, they said, Mike, would you, if you could turn back time here and go back, and if you wanted to spoke out about the election, wouldn't stand your ground. You know, look what they've destroyed, tried to destroy you. I said, I would never change a thing knowing what I know and knowing what this is critical. And that's where we're at. And it's because of all of you, because you buy our products. And that's why we're putting right now on sale our five flagship products. We have five flagship products, our biggest products of all time. For you go to mypillow.com/Alex, and you guys are going to see we've got the Giza Dream Sheets. If you put that thing up there, these are all for Christmas presents, you guys. You can get the best Christmas presents ever. The Giza Dream Sheets, the towels, the slippers. On the MyPillow Premiums, we've sold 85 million MyPillows because they work. You save over 50% on those. And then the mattress toppers made in the USA, $149.98, as low as that, depending on the size. But we got in the premium My Towels that actually work. You save 50% there, $39.98. And here's one of my favorites, the My Slippers. Best slippers in history. They're normally $149.98, $39.98. And once they're gone, they're gone. We can't get those back. They're made with impact gel, made out of soybeans. You walk on them, and it's like walking on a cloud. It's absolutely awesome, this patented gel that's in there. And then you have the Giza Dream Sheets. It's my favorite product. It's our president's favorite product. And as low as $29.98. And I'm going to show you one more. You guys go there. And you're getting five of these Bible pillows. These are very dear to me. They've got stories on the back. You get basically five Christmas gifts for $29.98 for all five. You got the baby Jesus, Noah's Ark, Daniel in the Lion's Den, but you get all five of them. So you get five individual gifts for under $6 a piece. Free shipping, promo code Alex on your entire order. No matter what you are, this is an exclusive free shipping on your entire order. So go to mypillow.com/Alex, and it's a win-win-win. You guys are supporting my employee-owned company. You're getting the best products at the best prices in history. You're supporting this great Alex's great show. I'll tell you, Alex, I can't be prouder, more proud than anyone that support your show and what you put out and help save this country more than anyone, and I mean that.
If you are receiving this transmission, you are the resistance.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is The War Room. I'm your host, Harrison Smith, InfoWars.com, band.video. Share those links. My guest in this final hour is Andrew F. Bronca. He's the host of The Bronca Show, providing pro-America, pro-Constitution, pro-Western civilization, political and legal analysis. Plus, he's funny. He's got the jokes and laughter to come along with it. The Bronca Show on X and YouTube.com/@TheBroncaShow. So I know you've said after the first question I asked that you just sort of noticed things and you were confused why nobody else was noticing them or something like that. And that's sort of been the theme of my entire episode today, especially talking about this Lost Generation story from Compact Magazine, where it's like suddenly everybody realizes that blatantly discriminating against white people isn't a good thing. And I have this mix of like, I'm glad people are talking about it. Good. This article is wonderful and, you know, really has some important information, but it's mixed with a frustration that nobody can see this for themselves and they have to have an article written for them. It's obvious that it's bad to discriminate against a group of people. What is wrong with everybody? Help me wrap my mind around this, Andrew. It's like, why is it so hard for people to see what's happening right in front of them?
Well, I think for different people, it's different reasons, right? I mean, DEI, for example, discriminating against white men is not bad for everybody in the near term. A lot of people get hired into jobs they wouldn't otherwise, well, they're not qualified for, but they wouldn't be eligible for. They're making money. They're building careers. They get to act as if they're superior in some way because, after all, they have those job positions. So they feel good about it. It's a better quality of life for them. They don't see, it's like someone who doesn't really know how to play chess. They can't see five or six moves ahead. They're living in the moment, almost like your dog lives in the moment. There's no foresight there into what the future will look like. So right now, things are happy for them, and they're happy to have it that way. They don't understand that virtually everything in life that we consider of value to us in improving our quality of life was invented by first world white dudes, virtually all of it. And we just take that all for granted. But the norm for human existence is abject poverty. And then in the modern era, we had the first world adopt things like the scientific method and reason and mathematics and apply it to a world of scarce resources to bring enormous wealth to everybody on the planet. But they're unable to see, or they can't for emotional reasons, see that the goose that laid the golden egg, continues to lay the golden egg, is not them. It's somebody else. It's a different culture than theirs. And that is, I think, in a sense, for many of these people, a humiliating experience. Of course, in any demographic, there are exceptional individuals. Every demographic on the planet has some geniuses in it. But when we're talking about large groups of numbers, you have to presume you're going to get something close to the average of what that particular demographic represents. There's a reason the third world looks like the third world. And there's a reason Central and South America look like they do. And there's a reason that Sub-Saharan Africa looks like it does. And it's not the geography. It's just not. It's the culture, and the culture is a reflection, at least in large part, of the IQ of those peoples. And we know this because if we take people from the first world, if we take people from Europe, and we drop them into the worst geography on the planet, places like Sub-Saharan Africa, suddenly we have a first world culture there. We have Rhodesia, we have white South Africa. And then when those people, those first world people, are driven out, it reverts back to its previous third world status before. So within our own lifetimes, well, at least within my lifetime, we have that history to look at. And I think it's really a reflection. I always tell my audience, it's always the same map. When you're confused about right. what's driving some social complexity or unpleasantness, just look at the world IQ map, and right. it really explains everything.
I was actually going to mention that in the last segment, the meme of there's one map, and it's the same for everything, development or like marrying your cousin, or I mean, you do a heat map over the world, and you find clusters in all the typical areas. And I had
whether
this,
it's poverty, whether how much trash there is in the environment. I mean, these are all reflections of the culture itself. And I think probably the single strongest driver of the nature of a culture is the average IQ of the population.
But you know what's bizarre is then you've got, you know, people that I think are sincere in their motives in America. They, you know, truly believe in global warming or whatever it is. They want to fight climate change. But then they're completely blind to it when you have China with these fishing fleets that are just destroying life in the oceans systematically as much as they possibly can. And that's what I don't understand, where it's like, okay, these people are high IQ. They are, you know, cognizant and aware of what's going on in general, but they just have this like imposed block that provides this cognitive dissonance where they cannot see the stupidity of offshoring all of our manufacturing to China, who has no environmental controls because of our environmental controls here. Like, it seems like they have the IQ sufficient to understand that, but they can't. And that's what I have trouble like wrapping my head around. Is it fear? Right. Are they lying?
No, they're acting like normal human beings. So you have to think of IQ as like a toolbox, right? You have a box full of tools that you can use. And the higher your IQ, the more tools you have and the more sophisticated those tools are. But that's not the person. The tools are just things the person can use to try to control, manage better their environment. Human beings are not intrinsically beings of reason. We're beings of emotion. And then we try to apply a facade of reason because it helps us better improve our world, helps our children survive. But we all know if someone's in a panic state, their powers of reason go right out the window. And so the kind of people you're talking about are just acting like normal human being, but they're succumbing to their emotional drivers. And it's wiping away that veneer of reason. They believe in things like global warming, and they probably believe in that as strongly as I believe in my faith. But that's what it is. For them, that's an article of faith. You could never reason them out of that belief. It doesn't matter how much evidence you show them. They didn't reason themselves into that position, so you can't reason them out of it. And because they're acting in an emotional way, it doesn't matter how big their toolbox is. They're just the toolbox has become invisible to them.
That makes a lot of sense. That is absolutely true. I mean, we know physiologically, like, you cannot think clearly if you're in a state of fear. So that's why it's so useful to create that state of fear if you're trying to pull one over on everybody. And when it gets to Africa, I agree with you that there's almost this like seething resentment, you know, that the first world exists and that they're not a part of it. But then it gets even further than that. Like, there's something else going on here. I have this from yesterday. This is the co-founder of the EFF party, which is the party you see walking around there chanting, kill the Boer, kill the white people. I guess he's in some new party now, but he's a politician in South Africa. And he responds to a post about Aranya saying, count your days, Aranya, you will be history soon. Right. So here's this group that takes over South Africa, decides they, you know, don't want white people in charge. The white people that aren't OK with that go, fine, we're leaving. They leave off to the wilderness, create their own community from scratch. Now the South Africans are saying, we're going to come and destroy that too. They don't even want it. It's not even like they're like, we want that. They just want to destroy it. That's the psychology that, again, I think begs an explanation. What is it about seeing other people succeed that just makes them want to destroy it? It's totally foreign to me.
But this only confuses civilized people. You know, when I was a kid, probably when you were a kid, most of us, when we were kids in school, we may have gotten bullied. And we might have thought, well, why can't I reason with this bully? Why can't I just talk him, explain to him why what he's doing is unreasonable? There's no need for this. We could get along. And the bully just punches you anyway. It's a very primitive emotion to do that. And that's the same primitive emotion happening here. The black South Africans cannot allow white South Africans to live with them because the difference in the standard of living will be so profound they can't explain it away. Well, if we're as good, how come we can't do those same things? They can't do the same things because they're not as good, not as humans, but just in terms of, again, IQ, problem-solving ability to work cooperatively, to not have a exploitative third-world low-trust kind of culture where everything is stolen. I mean, there's very basic aspects of the third world that Americans don't even think about. Even in America, we have low-trust communities, right? So if you live in a high-trust community, if your kid leaves his bicycle in the front yard, you have a reasonable expectation it'll still be there an hour later, right? Amazon delivers a package to your doorstep. It's probably going to be there when you get home from work. But there are large areas and communities in America where that's not true. I've lived in them. You leave your bike out in the front yard, it's gone in 3 minutes. You can't have packages delivered to your house because they're stolen as soon as anybody sees them. Well, that's what those are third world communities within America, low trust third world communities. And that's the entire third world is like that. That's what their culture is. So little things like trying to engage in construction, you can't leave construction materials unattended. They'll all get stolen. I mean, you're lucky if buildings don't get pulled apart from the materials they're made out of. Anything that's left unattended for even a moment. And from the people, the perspective of the people stealing it, they don't even feel a moral qualm about it. From their perspective, they would be fools not to take advantage of this opportunity to enrich them and theirs by simply taking these resources.
And in a way, it's sort of a self-fulfilling thing, right? Because if you get a critical mass of those types of people, then you are kind of an idiot if you don't take advantage of vulnerabilities. Right? If
you need 1%, 1% of them in it. Because, I mean, just think about it. You live in a nice first world high trust community, right? Your kids left his bikes out. It's never been stolen. You never had a package taken. If one family moves into that neighborhood, that is willing to steal your kid's bike or take your packages or take stuff out of your garage if you happen to leave your garage door open, how long does it take before you realize you can't do those things anymore? You have to make sure the bike's not in the yard, that packages are delivered elsewhere, that you keep your garage doors closed. One family turns the whole community into a low-trust community.
Or, you know, in another instance, if one group of people is hiring their ethnic cohort and discriminating against everybody else, and you don't do that, you're kind of out of luck. It kind of compels you that, I guess, if everybody else is doing it, I have to, too. So it's this feedback right. loop of immorality that once it starts going, it's really hard to stop it. Once people start taking advantage of this stuff, it's really hard to, convince
anyone. It's very fragile, this first world culture we've built, where we can presume that in general, not everybody, of course, even first world countries have their bad actors, but in general, people will act in good faith. That there's a people will follow the golden rule, that you know, your stuff's not going to be stolen the instant you turn your back. In general, we have that in first world cultures in America. But it's extremely fragile and it's lost like that. And now we're living in an America, 300 million people, roughly 340 million people. And we've imported into our fragile first world culture tens of millions of people from the third world who don't share that culture. And I'm not saying this to say they're bad people. They're just human beings from a low trust culture. And by neither inclination, temperament, or frankly, I think ability, are they likely to assimilate into a first world culture? It just doesn't happen. All the data tells us, two generations, three generations, four generations in, it hasn't changed. America has some success with a lot of work in assimilating migrants from other first world European countries. America's brought in immigrants from Italy and Poland and Germany, similar religious backgrounds, similar understanding of the role of the person to the state and how people should interact with each other in a golden rule sense. We have zero history of success in successfully assimilating any substantial numbers of people from the third world, any. And that's because they're so different from us.
And if there's no motive to, like, if there's no compulsion to integrate, why would you? I mean, when you drop 50,000 Somalis off in one area, they're going to maintain their behavior that they were in Somalia. Their family is all there, and it's very easy to silo yourself off. And that's a great example of exactly what you're talking about. We bring in all these Somalis. What happens 10 years later? There's $80 billion of fraud having been committed. And then when Ilhan Omar, the most prominent and visible leader, you know, leader of this community, is asked about it, she says it's the government's fault for not having better guardrails to stop the fraud. Right. So it's like,
but from her view, that's true. That's true. It would be like if you or I had a bag of money, right? A paper bag with $10,000 in it. And we just set it out in a parking lot someplace with lots of people. Wouldn't expect it to be left there. All right. People would say you're an idiot for doing that. But high trust cultures are very vulnerable to exploitation by low trust cultures because we don't set up the guardrails you would need to deal with a low trust. It takes a lot of effort and energy to do that, to presume that everybody you interact with is trying to steal from you. That it would be like having a social welfare program that was a convenience store with bulletproof glass and everything's locked up in a cabinet. We don't do that unless we need to. And if we're providing those services to high trust people, we don't need to. So we don't put those protections in place. But if a third world person comes in, it's like they're walking into one of these honor farm stands, you know, where you take a head of corn and you leave a dollar and everyone trusts each other. And they're like, well, I can just take the corn. I don't have to pay. Why wouldn't I do that? When these Somalians come in and they see, holy cow, we could steal $1 billion and without much effort, no one would even notice until long enough for us to get away with it. Why wouldn't they do that? So when Ilhan Omar says, well, it's your fault, you didn't put enough protections in, from her cultural perspective, she's 100% correct.
That really is a good way. That is a good way of putting it. Yeah, you just left a bag of money out. Of course it's going to get taken. Are you an idiot?
Right.
That's exactly how it is. And again, it's not even like you're even judging, you know, these people's cultures, it's literally just a fact. This is what the cultures are like. And I reference all the time videos of like Indian politicians that are driving around neighborhoods just throwing cash out the window because they're like, yeah, this is how you win the election. You bribe your electorate. And to us, that would be so offensive. This voting is this sacred thing that you're supposed to vote on your conscience. To them, they're like, no, he paid me the most. Of course, he's the best candidate. If I vote for him, he might pay me more. It's not like they're ashamed about this. It's not like they're hiding this. It's just this is the way it is.
It would never occur to them to be ashamed about it. They just don't have that kind of code of conduct, of behavior, of culture.
And that's fine for them, but like you bring it over here, it's completely incompatible. And then you even just have to look at our next door neighbor, Mexico. To see a world where you have to bribe every police officer you come in contact with, you have to, you know, be constantly bending the rules or trying to figure out what the it's exhausting. And I completely agree with you. It's a point I make quite a bit that the American people are not aware of the value of the thing that we're losing. This high trust society is not something that we can just recreate, you know, in a couple years. It took us 2000 years to develop this civilization and this society. And yet we're destroying it in a generation. It's sort of terrifying, actually.
Yeah, these high trust qualities, I think of them as like oil in an engine, right? It's what allows the engine to run efficiently. Right. You ever heard an engine run without enough oil in it? You know that's a bad day. But that's how third world cultures run. They don't have oil in them. And that's why they run so inefficiently. You have to take bribes. All your stuff is being stolen. You have to worry everyone you interact with is going to rip you off. The first world cultures were literally smart enough to say, hey, we could be a lot more efficient at all this if we didn't have to deal with all of that. Let's add some oil to the system. Plus, in Europe, in the Middle Ages, they were very aggressive about removing from the gene pool people who were social bad actors. They executed about 1% of the population every year, took their worst psychopaths, their worst actors out of the gene pool. And you do that over, you know, it's hard to affect the gene pool, but you do it over a couple hundred years, you'll have a real effect. It's a multi-generational effect. The third world doesn't do that. And so it almost concentrates bad actors within those populations.
Yeah. And again, it's, you know, if everybody's living that way and you're living that way, okay, fine. It's not the way I'd want to live, but you can at least survive. It's when you try to mix the high trust and the low trust that the high trust people just get destroyed and don't even know why it's happening because they, you know, they likewise can't conceive of the mindset of the low trust people.
You know, the funny thing is, of course, that they really know that it sucks to live in a first world culture. I mean, we don't have tens of millions of Americans trying to live in India. We have tens of millions of Indians trying to live in America. And their worst nightmare, you talk to an Indian in America, their worst nightmare is that they might be returned to India.
Right.
They love living in a first world culture because it is great. It's clean. People are generally honest. They know what it's like in India. They don't want to go back there. And by the way, I don't say any of this to be derogatory to any of these other cultures. I wish nothing but the greatest success for them. I wish India, I wish they were all billionaires. Sub-Saharan Africans, I hope they all become billionaires. I'm just pointing out that those cultures do not integrate or assimilate with first world cultures. And so when we import large numbers of them, not the top 1%, not just the geniuses, that's not what we're doing. Those people exist in those populations, but that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about bringing in large numbers of people. You have to expect to get close to the average of what those people represent. That's a problem. That's a huge problem for our nation because we end up with a balkanized country and an utter destruction, poisoning of our own first world culture.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Couldn't agree more. And again, you know, if you bring over just the top 0.01% of a country, they're probably going to have a high enough IQ and they're going to come in low enough numbers that it's fine. It's not destabilizing. But then when you bring over the population transfer like they're doing, it's obviously not going to work. Shifting gears just a little bit and going back to what we were talking about earlier in this hour and trying to connect it all. The Compact Magazine article talks about the way that obviously this diversity trend is destroying America. These institutions that have adopted it are cratering and collapsing. And yet it's all sort of predicated on this bizarre distortion of capitalism. And maybe it's my conspiratorial mind, but it seems like the push is to destroy the reputation of capitalism. And the people that are imposing DEI know how destructive it is, and they're doing it so they can say, see, capitalism doesn't work. We need a new system. What do you think how likely do you think that scenario is? What do you think of the state of capitalism today as we see so many young people abandoning capitalism and going towards socialism?
I think it's a very complicated multivariant question because I think different actors involved in these conversations have their own different perceptions, their own different drivers. Anyone who knows anything knows that capitalism is the only way to create wealth. So people advocating for socialism, they're doing it from the privileged position of living in a capitalist country. Right. The people that advocate DEI and these giant corporations, they can get away with it because they're working in the privileged position of a corporation that makes a ton of money thanks to capitalism and can afford, at least in the short term, the drag that DEI imposes. They don't really want socialism, at least if they knew what they were talking about, if they knew what that existence would be like. Socialism is poverty everywhere. You look at the Scandinavian countries, they're not really socialist. They're capitalist countries. People there make a lot of money. The top echelon make a lot of money from their natural resources, the gas and oil in the North Sea and elsewhere. And then they have huge social safety networks, but they're not socialist. They're capitalist countries. It's the only way to make money. But if you make enough money, you can afford a lot of drag, right? You can have a very draggy boat, but you put enough engines on it, it'll still go quick.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, and I just think it's a failure of the Republican Party mostly to actually make the argument for capitalism, because it seems to me like the only people talking about the economic woes of the average young person now is somebody who's just socialist going, hey, see that billionaire? I'll take his money and give it to you. And for people that are just – they just want, you know, to get their feet under them, that's fine, whatever it takes. So I worry about that trajectory that it's going.
Well, the Republican Party sucks.
Well, yeah, I know.
They
I
suck.
Know.
They're 1 degree less sucky than the Democrats. That's the best I can say for them.
So what do we do about that? I know we only have 2 minutes, Lee, here. You're not going to solve our political crisis in 2 minutes, but what do we do about the Republicans?
Yeah, MAGA. We have to envision a MAGA party, an American First party, not as a third party. Third parties don't work in America. But we have to do what Trump started, which is basically to co-opt the traditional GOP and take it over as a MAGA party. We need to demand from candidates that they're talking the MAGA talking points. We're stopping this H-1B nonsense. We're getting rid of these migrants. A lot of the stuff that Trump is already doing and talking about, that we're careful about the kind of federal judges we pick. People have to be saying the right things. And a lot of it's going to be new, by the way, because anyone who's been in the GOP is corrupted already by the system. So a lot of these are going to be new candidates without a lot of track record. They need to be saying the right things. And then, of course, the proof is in the pudding. They need to do the right things once they're in. And then we need to be absolutely vicious about holding accountable those that don't do that. But part of that is we have to have options. We have to have a lot of candidates going into place. We have to encourage people to run for office at every level of government as MAGA candidates. Otherwise, we're just going to lose the war. It's like if you want to win a war, but you don't have anyone willing to fight. What's the point? You may as well save yourself a lot of trouble and just lose. But I heard your comments about that article before we started. A lot of people feel like they've lost already. They've given up. And that's one way to go. That's not my way. My way is I'd rather fight and die in the fight than just give up and lay down.
Hey, if you're going to kill me, you're going to have to try really hard. I'm not just going to lay down and let you do it. And I think you find once you stand up, it's not only do you not die, you can actually win. It's actually incredible. This has been awesome. We could talk for hours. Andrew F. Barca has been my guest Bronca. And am I pronouncing that right? Bronca?
Yeah, that's fine. Don't worry about it.
Bronca. It's B-R-A-N-C-A. Andrew F. Bronca. The Bronca Show. YouTube.com/The Bronca Show. Thank you so much for being here with us. Keep up the fantastic work, sir. Amazing stuff. All right, folks. That's going to do it for us. We'll see you back here tomorrow. Make sure to go to thealexjonesstore.com today to keep us on the air, in the fight, and winning incredible victories.
Quick, I just wanted to plug the Methylene Blue. I'm a new supplement buyer from Alex Jones Store, and I keep hearing people talking about the Methylene Blue, and I'm like, you know what? I don't know what the hype is all about, but I definitely want to try it. And what I noticed is I didn't get the sensations that a lot of the other people said that they got, you know, like the tingling fingers and like this, you know, euphoria. But I do have an ample amount of energy, and I'm disabled, so I'm a housewife, and whenever you're at home, day in and day out, 7 days a week, it really tends to drag after some time. And there were things that I wasn't doing around the house that I should have. But now I'm getting things done like really quick. I have all this extra time on my hands now. And I really think it's the methylene blue that's been giving me the energy. And it's so funny because now, like, my silly husband's calling me a meth head, which is hilarious. But, yeah, so I'm going to stick on that. And I actually have some bovine coming in today, so I can't wait to try that out. I'm also going to give that to my dog because, you know, I need a lot of help too. And I brought online that's really good for your dog if you give them, like, a small little amount of the food. So I'm going to do that. But yeah, I just thought I would tell you guys about my experiences so far. So,
well, Jen, thank you. That's amazing to hear, and we love to hear that, honestly. I mean, that's the reason why Alex has created the shop, so people can get, you know, get healthier, not be relying on big pharmaceutical companies, but instead take control of their health. So that's good to hear. You know, I've fluctuated weight-wise too. And so finding something that works is really important. And not to get hooked on those, like, high caffeine, insane chemicals, energy drinks, which so much of us have relied on over the years. I literally was getting anxiety from one of them. And so I too am on the blue these days. So I guess your husband would call me a meth head, but it's good to hear from you, Jen. I love it. I think it's great. And I love to hear from you as well.
If you are receiving this transmission, you are the resistance.